Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
I can make you number one on Google if you act now. We're hearing all that kind of crap when we open our email, you know, marketing, get you to get your website ranked number one on Google, you know, get traffic, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we're here to kind of, undo the hype, but not underhype either, about digital marketing. Maybe you're a small business owner. Maybe you work for a nonprofit. Maybe you work for a big company. Maybe you're not in marketing at all or have anything in interest in marketing, but you probably should know something about digital marketing because we're all trying to promote something. What really works now? There's so many options now. Facebook, Google, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, blogs, Yelp, YouTube. Help us figure it out. In the studio with me is Greg Sterling. He writes a blog called Screenwork and focuses on digital marketing. He's contributing editor at Search Engine Land. Puts together these boot camps, unfortunately not in San Francisco, but all over the country. So $30, I can't believe it. We'll talk about that later. And he's vice president of strategy. Oh, that's what it is. He's vice president of strategy and insights for the local search association. That's, you know, search engine and stuff like that. Greg Sterling, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So everybody knows, you got to have a website, you got to have a blog, and you want it to rank high on Google. So everybody knows you got to keep posting great content and get key websites to link to your site. So you go and you beg, you write some article for some blog, and of course it's got a link to your website back, so you get these things called backlinks. But we want to go beyond the obvious. Let's say I'm a career counselor, which I am, and I'm specializing, let's say, in gifted kids, which I do care about gifted kids because I think they're totally ignored in the schools today. And I want to ask the people who run the most popular sites and blogs for parents of gifted kids to put a link on their site to my site or blog. Okay, maybe I'm going to write an article, as I said. So beyond that, that's the timeless stuff. I could have said that in 1987. It's 2015. We're in the second half of it. What other ideas that are practical for, a non-genius, a regular person to use to drive traffic to my site or my blog?
Well, first, you're assuming that everybody wants to write a blog. A blog is a pain in the ass.
You're right.
Do you write a blog?
Absolutely, I'm a maniac.
Right.
But for most people, don't. Right.
So you have to be really driven. You have to be committed to writing. You have to write all the time, a few times a week,
that's
daily.
A pain. But sites, everybody's got to have a site, right?
Right. Everybody needs some sort of web presence.
So what do I do with my what am I do to get my website? Let's say I hire somebody to do the writing for the website or the blog. I'm the crazy person who does the writing, but in most cases, people don't. All I know is I got this website. I know I got to get eyeballs there. Maybe to see my cute little video that I have about telling me how wonderful my plumbing business is or candy store. What do I do to drive eyeballs there?
All right. Well, so there's a bunch of different strategies, but the idea is that you need to get deeply into this community of people online who are interested in your subject, right? So there are top sites where people go, there are forums, there are discussion groups. You need to meet all those people. You need to comment on those blogs. You need to post links to your own content where it makes sense. You should start a newsletter, collect email addresses. You should use social media, Facebook and Twitter, to promote your blog content, post links on those sites, drive people back, build followers on those sites. We can talk about the content.
Let's make it specific. So, so many of my listeners are very non-profit-y. That's the KLW listenership. So let's say I work for a Save the Whale Foundation. I just made that up. So I'm the Save the Spotted Owl and Whale Foundation. And let's say I am one of the people who works there and a member of the team. Maybe I'm not the director of marketing, but I've got some role in marketing I'm interested in. Let's slow down. What should I, at my next staff meeting, bring up as a interesting, cool, and cost-effective thing that we should be doing to get more money for the Save the Whale Foundation?
Okay, digital marketing. Well, I'd say social media is the first stop for you guys.
And that could mean anything: Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat.
That's right.
What do you want me to do first, and why?
Okay, Facebook is first because it has the largest audience.
Good. What do I do there?
You create a page.
Okay.
Okay, and you put all your initiatives. publicize everything that you're doing, education, political action, fundraising, solicitation, everything that you want to do. Here's what's here's our calendar. Here's what's going on. You invite people to events. You expose people to all your activities. And hopefully you generate some followers, right? You generate people who like your page and who will follow you.
How do you get people to visit your page for the first time? I've made this nice page. I've got all these wonderful events. How do I get people to come to my Facebook page?
Use other things. Okay? Facebook advertising, Twitter, Google, your own website. Like us on Facebook. I mean, you see that all over the place. You can use offline stuff, right? You can put it on your stationery. You can put it on your, you know, you can put it on outdoor advertising. So people ignore traditional media and offline media, direct mail. You can do all of that stuff and cross-promote everything.
I've had some clients who are both users of social media as a marketing tool as well as providers. And there is, it feels sometimes a little smoke and mirrors. It's one thing to get a lot of Facebook likes, but does it translate into dollars? Does it, you know, it takes an effort, like you said, it's multidimensional to get people to even come to your damn Facebook page.
Right.
And, you know, it's another thing to say, here is my $150 donation to Save the Whale Foundation.
Right.
You know,
well,
is it overhyped, this whole thing?
Well, so a lot of people have expectations that may be unrealistic. So they think that, you know, I'm going to do something over here on Facebook and it's going to generate a bunch of revenue immediately. Some of these strategies are longer term strategies. In the case of a nonprofit, Save the Whale organization, you can do fundraising on your Facebook page. You can link directly to, shopping cart and get people to, you know, here's what we're doing. Here's why we need your contributions. We're trying to lobby this or that legislator to enact a ban. And so you can directly solicit funds either through Facebook advertising or on your page.
Off the air, you mentioned something that sounded very cool called Beacon.
Yeah.
Is there any, you know, if I'm this nonprofit, Beacon has to do with on local things, monitoring you locally.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's good for stores, but let's say I'm putting on all these events.
Yeah.
I've got fundraising events. I've got community engagement events. I've got, you know, what is Beacon and does it apply to me at all?
So beacons are little pieces of hardware that are about as big as your mobile phone. They can be as small as a quarter. They have a little software. They have chip and software inside of them. They send out a signal. Your phone can pick it up. They can transmit messages to you. Hi, welcome to the store. Or, thanks for coming. Or $10 off on your next, you know, giant cup of coffee or whatever it is. They send out a signal. And they can do selected things that are tied into location. Very, very short range devices.
So how is that different? I mean, why couldn't I simply put up a billboard? Let's say I'm this nonprofit,
yep,
and I've got this wonderful event, and I'm wanting to do fundraising before I do fundraising. So I want the visitors just walked into our Save the Whale, education event, and I want you to see the cool video that we've created. I could obviously send that, use a beacon and send that to your phone, say, come, you know, in 10 minutes we're starting this this wonderful movie on the endangered whale. But I could also simply put up a pencil and paper sign. I could put a piece of butcher paper up and say, 10 minutes, come to the thing. What's the advantage of beacon?
Well, in that case, the paper sign might be more effective because you don't have
everybody
to worry about
it.
You don't have to worry about all the complexity. So to receive a notification, so beacons will generate notifications on your phone, and to get one of those, you got to have an app. So you'd have to have the Save the Whale app installed. Otherwise, people wouldn't be able to see that.
So this is really a kind of a new, I know that Google is invested in this beacon thing and Apple.
Yep.
But right now you're saying it's not ready for prime time. Is that an accurate statement?
For most small businesses, it's not something that they can use effectively. But you can start thinking about using it in conjunction with somebody else to help you track people coming into your
all
store.
Right.
It's like a door counter.
Before we go to the phones, I do want to go to the phones and get people to call
yep.
in. But if there's one other thing, I am this nonprofit. I'm the Save the Whale Foundation, and there's, you know, obviously I'm going to try to have a nice Facebook presence. I'm going to put my say, you know, like us on Facebook or whatever. Here's a link to our donate now button.
And you might want to use Snapchat. You might want to use Instagram because younger people might be sympathetic to your cause, and those are audiences that are concentrated in those places.
As I understand, am I not right that Snapchat is what young people are using, and Instagram is what more middle aged people are using?
Well, that's sort of true. So the age distribution on Instagram is broader than on Snapchat. Snapchat is of Facebook. Instagram, Snapchat. Snapchat is the youngest. Instagram's in the middle. Facebook is for old folks now.
Okay, so now if I want to use Instagram, and I want to use it to raise money, lay out for me what, because that's what I care about. In the end,
well,
the lifeblood of
my... Well, you can't do direct fundraising on Instagram.
What can I, how will I, not direct, but I care about whatever, friend raising.
You want to publicize your cause.
Right.
You want to generate awareness.
What do I do? If you are my consultant, and I am at the Save the Whale Foundation, and I want to use Instagram to get my kind of middle-aged clients who are visually, or obviously Instagram is about visual, where Facebook is more texty.
I don't know how middle-aged they are, but they're some of them are over 35, yes.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, that counts and that enters middle-aged history at end of 40. Especially in the tech world, anything over 18 is considered middle-aged.
Yeah, anything over 5, I think, is middle-aged now.
What are you saying? What is?
No, I was just joking. Everything over 5. Anything
yeah,
over
exactly,
5.
Exactly, right. Exactly. So, okay. So I'm looking, let's say, you know, I've got my the old fart donors. I'm going to get to them through snail
through
mail.
Direct mail or
right.
Or
but
telephone.
Now I want to get to, there are the, you know, let's say.
Well, no. So that's an excellent point, right? So let me stop you. So in the old days, you had TV, you had radio, you had newspapers and yellow pages and direct mail. Now you've got these 10 bazillion channels.
Right.
And one way to think about them is user intent and audience, right? So people search on Google when they're looking for something to buy or they're doing research. People are browsing on Facebook. People are killing time on their mobile phones. They're also searching. So there are different kinds of behaviors that exist on all of these things. These different sites also have different audiences, and it's important to think about behaviors and audiences, and some of them overlap.
Okay. So let's say I want people in their 30s who I know are represented widely in Snapchat, in Instagram, and I want to use, and they're...
You haven't mentioned Pinterest yet.
Yeah, well, Pinterest seems like just posting just pictures. It feels like that's only...
That can be very effective.
But that's like just fashion stuff.
Well, but especially if of the several sites, right? Now, Facebook just instituted a buy button, right? So they're going to get into e-commerce. But if you're talking Facebook, or if you're talking Instagram, Snapchat, and Pinterest, if you're selling stuff...
Right.
Or even services. Pinterest is probably the best one for you.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, back to Instagram.
Back to our whales. Well, I'm interested in saving our whales, or at least my listeners are. So, dear listeners, I am interested in saving whales too. Anyway, I want to use Instagram in order to get my visually oriented people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s at least better brand awareness, caring about my caring to save whales.
Yep.
What might I do on Instagram to do that?
You can do video. You can do still photographs, right? So you can post photographs and captions, and you can post video. So if you're out doing like Greenpeace, right? If you're out sort of intercepting Japanese or Norwegian whaling ships, you want to take video of that and put it up there.
Why is it better? I can put video on Facebook. Why do I need?
You can do video on Facebook.
So
for
why
sure.
in the world do I need? You know, all these different platforms. Why the hell don't I just do it all on Facebook and then not divide my attention?
Well, the beauty is that you can do much of this stuff on multiple sites. So you can take your pictures and you can take your video and push them out to a lot of sites, including Twitter. And you know, you might want to do that, but if you're trying to reach young people in particular, Snapchat or Instagram might be more effective than Facebook, although Facebook advertising is very powerful because you can target audiences. And for small businesses, you can do what's called geotargeting, which is show an ad within a certain geographic radius from your store.
So great. So let's take that Facebook ad thing, because that's what I'm hearing, is that you may do better using Facebook ads. In the old days, you didn't. You were just trying to get likes. But now, apparently, Facebook ads can be smart. If I am the Save the Whale Foundation and I want to take out, would you advise me to take out a Facebook ad, and what guidance would you give me about how to do that?
So they have all kinds of so Facebook structures its advertising around objectives: clicks to your site, driving people into your store, generating awareness. So that's one thing to think about. What are you trying to achieve? Are you trying to get people to your website, whatever? You could take people to a fundraising page, for example. The other thing is you can target audiences by geography, by interest, gender. So if you know who are the most likely people to give money to you, if they're women 40 to 55 and they live in certain parts of the country where you've had success through direct mail, you can do that same targeting on Facebook. You can do lots of really super sophisticated stuff. Like you can upload your email list and find those people on Facebook and target them with a message. So your previous donors, you can find them on Facebook and say, hey, we really need your help again.
The problem with the earlier generation of ad buying in digital media was Google Ads, Google AdWords, and it ended up being very often too expensive because you were in an auction situation.
Right.
You were bidding on words, and so the cost of those ads became crazy. Are Facebook ads more cost-effective?
Well, Facebook is also an auction, but they can be cheaper, lower dollar amounts. So for very competitive keywords on Google, it can be quite expensive. If you're talking about lawyers, and you can pronounce the word, the asbestos cancer, I can't pronounce it.
Mesothelioma, right?
Right, so that's very expensive. It can be like $100 a click or whatever.
Right.
But certain, you know, more targeted keywords can be cheaper. Facebook generally can be cheaper.
Do you have any intuitions as to what of course, you have to test keywords, right? If I am my Save the Whale Foundation, do you have any intuitions as to the kind of keywords I should use that are not going to be so expensive, but target me, help me get my money, or is that... Am I asking for too much specificity? Is that something you have to research?
For the Save the Whale campaign?
Yeah.
You want to do stuff that isn't super competitive. I mean, you want to target... if you're trying to build awareness or you're trying to raise money, people often do searches based on news or headlines. So if there's some incident, you might want to take advantage of that and use those as keywords. So let's say Japanese whaling ship intercepted in the Pacific. So if there's some news story that has some interesting stuff about it, you might want to build a campaign around that. But this brings me to an important point, which is that you can do a lot of these things yourself. And certain things are easier to do than others, but sometimes you really need a professional, somebody who's dedicated and can tell you what best practices are.
How the hell do you find? I mean, there's just so many out there. Like I said, there are those. I get phone robocalls. I get emails. Rank number one on Google.
Yeah.
How the hell, really? I mean, do you just go to Yelp and just use the social digital media to find the right vendor? Other than the personal recommendation, what advice do you have on finding somebody?
Well, you need to talk to your colleagues and friends, see if you can get some referrals. People have had experience. You need to do searches on the names of these companies and see what other people have said about them. Very often, they've been reviewed. People have talked about their experience. These guys are hucksters. They totally rip me off. These guys are good. So you can collect a lot of information just by going to Google or Yelp and plugging in the name of the company. And then you can ask for demos. You can ask for referrals. You can ask for people to give you testimonials. And I would check them out. Do nothing on impulse.
So we're going to go to the phones now, but I want you to tell the listeners, what kind of calls would you like to get? Where can you be most helpful to them? What kind of calls? What do you want people to say? What kind of reasons do you want people to call about?
Well, I am not somebody who, on a day-to-day basis, as I said to you earlier, works under the hood and is setting up Facebook ad campaigns. I mean, I can talk about broad trends. I can talk about strategy. What business owners and nonprofits should be doing, where they should concentrate their attention. I can offer some specific advice on Google or Yelp. I can talk a lot about reviews. I can talk about...
What do you mean about reviews?
Well, reviews... So nonprofits may or may not be interested in reviews, but every business that has an offline component or physical storefront has to have reviews.
Sure, and I would think even... that would be, I don't know if it exists, but that would be, there are these, I'm not crazy about the review sites for nonprofits like Charity Navigator,
right,
and GuideStar, because they're...
Most people don't know about them and don't look them up.
And even if you do, they're not great because they're only talking about overhead, and that's a messy thing.
It's very, too much complexity. People's eyes roll back in their head.
So, dear listener, here's my business idea of the day. I'd like you to create a Yelp for nonprofits, where people would review the services they got from a nonprofit, review the sense of how much bang the buck they got for the buck they got for their donations, and I think that might be a useful
tool. It's a simpler version of Charity Navigator.
Yeah, but I think Charity Navigator doesn't have reviews.
Yeah,
I think
Yelp meets Charity Navigator.
There you go. Yelp meets, like on screenplay writing. They're always asking you to compare two movies. This meets that.
Right.
Anyway, dear listeners, meet Greg Sterling. He is a kind of a digital marketing guru. And the phone number, and I will, of course, throw my
I wouldn't call myself a guru, but
okay.
But I do own a domain, Greg, gregsterling.guru.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, and so you're going to get two for the price of one. If he can't help you, I will try to stick my two cents in. So if you would like some guidance about digital media, or you're simply a listener to the show who's not planning to do anything with digital media, but you're curious about something, you have a question, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Well, you wanted to say something, it looks
no,
like.
I'm involved in a lot of small business surveys, consumer surveys, and I spend a lot of time looking at technology trends, and I can talk about all that stuff.
So what's a trend? What's something you've seen? What's a trend you're seeing that that'd be fun for us to hear about?
Well, there's a lot of sort of esoteric stuff that isn't in people's daily lives is pretty interesting. Virtual reality is an example of something that's really fascinating to me that I think down the line will be a big deal. Starts off in gaming, but then it can go into education, travel,
Of
course, virtual sex. There's that.
Woody Allen wrote about that
it's going to be real. So, there's a lot of interesting things there. Of course, mobile is huge. Everybody has a smartphone, but there's all kinds of stuff going on there. I can talk about privacy.
You know what I want to talk about before we're going to go to the phones now,
yep.
But let's take a minute. I'm curious. We were starting to talk about location-specific. I would think location-specific digital marketing is kind of a holy grail. And so tell me about the difference between – well, let me say this. I was looking for a refrigerator, and I played on the Sears site, and I decided I'm not ready to buy it yet. But I ended up I'm constantly seeing ads for Sears refrigerators next to every damn website I go to. What's that about, and how does that, is that, that sounds very potent.
It is. It's quite effective. It's either called retargeting or remarketing. Typically, you go to a website, as you said, Sears, Home Depot, Best Buy, and they drop a little cookie or a pixel, which is a kind of a similar thing, onto your computer, and then they can identify you when you come to another website. Happens on Facebook. Happens to me when I look for hotels. I'm looking at a hotel room, and I decide not to book. Then I go to Facebook, and I see the ad for that very hotel. And it can be quite effective.
Yeah, I actually don't mind it, because at least it's targeted
to
me.
It reminds you.
And unlike, if I'm seeing an ad that says, make your penis grow 6 inches longer.
Well, in fact, this is something that I did, right? So they have this little ad choices icon that people notice in the corner of these ads, and you can opt out of receiving these targeted ads. So I did that just to see what would happen, right?
Yeah.
So if you opt out of seeing these ads, what you get is Christian Singles and Viagra. Right, those are the two broad ad campaigns that you see, and it's horrible. So you want to be targeted by these ads that are more relevant.
Anyway, now let's go. I'll give out the phone number again, but we have callers on the line. If you have a question about digital marketing for my guest Greg Sterling, with my two cents thrown in, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We do have lots of lines lighted up, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's your question or comment for Greg Sterling?
Hi, is that me?
It is.
Hi, great. Well, I'm the first one. Well, I've been a long-time online advertiser. My business, Himalayan Bowls, I'm online only. And, the conversation is very interesting, but the point I wanted to make is it's not enough to say, oh, this age range, it's a 30-year-old, I should advertise on Facebook. What I found is a lot of experimentation is necessary to figure out what actually gets you a result. For a long time, I didn't get any results with Facebook ads, for example, whereas I get a huge result with I've had Google AdWords going for over 12 years. But the thing that I found is very effective is the kind of message for those various platforms too. Like on Facebook, when I import products from Nepal, so when I did a big Facebook campaign that, hey, I'm going after this grant to help Nepal and I'm increasing my imports to help Nepal, then I started seeing sales coming through from my Facebook campaigns. But when I just say, hey, 20% off or whatever, I don't often get the same kind of response.
I think
it's the way you use the social media.
You're absolutely right. I mean, there are layers and layers of sophistication here, and we're just talking at a high level. We have a very brief time here to talk about this, but you're absolutely right. That the one truism that can be said about digital marketing that's different from traditional is that you have to test, you have to iterate, you have to try things, try and fail. It's very experimental, and it's not set it and forget it. You used to buy a Yellow Page ad, next year you'd buy another one. This is continuous, as you're suggesting, and so you're absolutely right. And there are different use cases. So you can broadly think of Facebook as awareness and Google as kind of direct response. That's an oversimplification, but that's one way to think
about
it.
You know, the other it's a wonderful takeaway. There are two vectors, two mega trends that your approach is emblematic of. One is we're doing very much social, much more social consciousness marketing. Every company is trying to show how socially conscious they are. And we're also emotional. So the combination of immediately right after the Nepal earthquake, you pulling on that, you know, is brilliant. It's emotionally connecting. It's tied to social consciousness, especially the kind of people, given that you were importing stuff from Nepal before, tying it to the earthquake and the aftermath, how really amazingly resilient and quiet and non-looting the Kathmandu people were, is really pretty brilliant. And I imagine that's why it worked. Is that a fair statement?
It's a way to really help people, too. And I think to use social media in the true sense, I mean, for a business to be able to do that and help a social concern is a real rare and good opportunity. I mean, we're all sorry it happened, but it's also a really good way to be able to reach out and help people directly.
You bet. I want to thank you.
Question too: is there anything new that everything I've been hearing so far? I'd like a couple of new ideas. I'm making a lot of new videos, and I want to use Pinterest more. Is there anything? I feel like I'm a little tapped out as an online retailer, and would like to know what's on the horizon or what new suggestions you have.
Greg?
Well, I mean, are you doing anything in mobile?
I have just actually launched my new website last week, which has an all-new, really nice mobile site.
Yeah, I mean, mobile is obviously a huge thing. More mobile searches now than PC searches. You know, you really got to focus a lot of attention there.
That's really important, actually, because I found just in the last year or two, I'm now getting like 40% of my users mobile.
Yeah, and for the top 100 sites, half of the audience is mobile only. So if you're not doing mobile stuff, you're really missing out on potentially half your customer base.
Amazing. You know, I want to. You talked about video. I want to suggest something that I'm curious both your reactions to. If I were selling items from Nepal and other kind of, say, troubled areas, I might try. I wouldn't go through the cost of creating my own, but if there's probably a ton of video out there that are public domain or you could get access to, and creating maybe the start of the video might be you talking about the fact that you're trying to do well by doing good, and you were very moved by the crises that exist in these countries, and then you show little clips, either stills or little 2 or 5 second little video clips of the human beings in those countries, maybe the artisans themselves that are making the stuff or whatever, and then you end the 1 minute video with a call to action and a link to your website. What do you guys think of that idea?
I've actually did a few of those. You can see on YouTube, if you look for me, Himalayan Bowls, or I think the one is called Singing Bowls to Help Nepal, and I made a long video. I was actually in Nepal 6 months ago and shot some video of the Kathmandu Durbar Square, which is one of the main ancient spiritual sites that was completely flattened by the earthquake. So I have video that I shot talking about what an amazing experience it is being in this crossroads that's been there for centuries, and then superimposed with images 6 months later of the place just completely devastated, along with messages from my friends and suppliers saying, please help us, you know, we need more business activity, how they're depending on exports because the tourism is now completely dead. So it's very strong messaging, and I've already done that and put up a few videos. I applied for the Chase Mission Main Street $100,000 business grant, which I got a lot of support from Facebook people to support my application for that, and I'm waiting to hear back from Chase.
What you're talking about is excellent. So you're telling a story of a place. You're making it very personal. You're giving some behind the scenes insight. That general rule applies to anybody. So not just people who are in situations of kind of distress or exotic locations, but even, you know, I was talking, Marty, about the Mariposa Bakery in Oakland, you know, gluten-free bakery. They do a lot of stuff with social media. There's a lot of sort of, here's what we're doing behind the scenes. Here are the people. You want to tell stories, especially in social media, about your business, why it exists, what you're trying to accomplish, and personalize it, humanize it. This is what people love.
Yeah. You know,
I've
got two reactions. One, the notion of trial and error. Trial and error can fail and trial and error can succeed. In the end, it matters of how savvy and how smart you are. And it comes down to first understanding your customer very well. And really literally talking to the people who bought, if they made a phone order, chatting with them and finding out about who they are, what motivates them, et cetera, what they like and don't like. And, of course, then it's also looking at your analytics. And so that your trial and error is not likely to lead to as many errors. The second thing is, it is sobering to me how much damn work is required to run a simple little business like Himalayan Bowls. You've got this massive marketing effort. You know, you can understand why people want a government job, you know, why they want stability.
Those don't exist anymore.
They exist. They exist. The largest employer.
And you have to be really passionate, but it's really worth it. It's really true what you say. I sell one product. I've been doing it for 15 years. I just spent 3 months with my developers developing my new site. It's a constant effort, you know, like any business. But it's also worth it. It's given me a lot of freedom. I can work remotely a lot of the time. I'm able to help, you know, keep this traditional handicrafts alive. The thing that I think to impress with this talk about advertising, though, for me, it's really easy. I have one keyword, you know, singing bowl. That's pretty much it. And I really, you know, hats off to people who have more competitive businesses or more complicated sets of keywords and metrics that they have to deal with. For me, it's very straightforward.
It still is
a lot of work, like you said, Martin.
One thing that goes back to an earlier point about keywords and buying competitive keywords or not buying competitive keywords, you can use social media to stimulate demand for searches and then buy those keywords, right? So singing bowls is a unique keyword that is unlikely to be bought by somebody else. Very, very, you know, little competition. If you can expose that on YouTube and elsewhere, people will then come back and search for your thing. Oh, I saw that cool bowl site, singing bowls. There you are, number one position, either for SEO or the ads, or both. And then they come to your site. So you can generate awareness, stimulate demand and searches, and you can buy those keywords. That's something that people can do in your situation.
Have you tried other keywords
for other people who own a unique kind of business? Is that you actually create a market that?
That's
way,
right. That's exactly right. But people don't know to search for singing bowls without some other stimulus.
Have you tried the other way around, like, you know, Himalayan spiritual items? You know, have you found other terms that are not specific to singing bowls?
That's something that I've gone through for years and other advertisers have to watch for, because you end up with a lot of people who are looking for information but not necessarily buying stuff, and you have to really kind of balance that and find a budget that works for you to have keywords.
That's right. And final point on that, the broader the keywords, the less likely people are going to be ready to buy. The more specific the keywords, the more likely they're in a buying mode, because they're looking very specifically. It's like the difference between refrigerator and GE model XYZ.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I want to thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it. We're going to take one more call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's your question for Greg Sterling about digital marketing?
Hi, Greg. Marty, great show.
Thank you.
I have a home care franchise. I don't know if you're familiar with Home Care, Greg, but we provide caregivers that go to the individual's home, generally elderly, to keep them independent. And our general market is generally 75, 80 years and above, living independently, families away from home, nearby, but doesn't really support them at the home. Our referral sources are generally their kids who are in about their 60s, 50s, 60s, and they could be spread out around the United States, generally in California. And my franchise is particularly located in the Bay Area. What would you suggest is a good strategy for digital marketing?
Well, so you're saying that the kids of the elderly people who are the clients of your service are the primary referrers, is that right?
Yep. Correct.
Yeah. So a lot of the when people get to the place where they need to get that kind of home care, Google, they're going to look on Google, but you know, an article in a newspaper, Something on Facebook that makes them aware of your service, even sort of ahead of, you can do that kind of age range targeting on Facebook. My mom, who's in her mid to late 70s, is a user of Facebook. So you need to build awareness, but people will also be looking for those services, home caregivers, in-home nursing, etc.
I have a feeling that this has become a very crowded market. And I also think because it's a very emotional buy, digital marketing may not be your best vehicle. Your best vehicle may be doing workshops in the Bay Area for boomers with aging parents called The Seven Things You Must Do to Help Keep your Aging Parent Independent. Does that make sense?
That's an excellent suggestion. I think that people forget about traditional outreach like that, events, seminars, and I think that used in combination with some sort of online presence where people can follow up and get more information is excellent.
I want to thank you for the call. Last question. We got to let you go. There is, moving forward, there is a new kind of potentially very powerful digital marketing technique called geoconquesting. Tell us about that.
So geoconquesting is a version of what I described earlier, geofencing. You set you have a point, your business, and then you set a notification or an ad for a certain radius from your business. Geoconquesting is the same thing, but the point is the competitor. So every time somebody goes within 5 miles or a mile of your competitor, they'll see a notification or an ad for your business. $10 off. Hey, come back and visit us. Whatever it is, it's a mobile a tactic, and it can be very effective.
So it's going to be something like, if I own a falafel stand and I'm near the downtown UC Berkeley campus and there are 4 falafel places within, a quarter of a mile, I'm on my phone and I'm going to, if I come into your area, I'm going to see I'm going to get a coupon good for $2 off a falafel?
That's very possible, yes.
Okay. But what I need a special app for your store, or how do they know about
me? So geoconquesting can be in the form of an ad that shows up on a third party app. You don't necessarily need an app for that. A notification requires an app. Yes, that's a longer conversation.
Okay. Well, we've had a not too long conversation, but a middle length conversation. And so, Greg Sterling, I want to thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko. You do you're involved with an organization that does boot camps for.
Right. So the Local Search Association is the old Yellow Pages Association, evolved now with a focus on digital. We're doing several small business digital education boot camps, different parts of the country. Unfortunately, not one in the Bay Area right now, but we've got Charlotte coming up on the 26th of this month. That's just a week from today. Atlanta, Portland, and Austin will probably do more. The website is thelsa.org, thelsa.org. My email is greg.sterling@gmail.com, S-T-E-R-L-I-N-G. Send me any questions that you didn't get to ask, and I'll be happy to follow up with you.
Greg, thanks very much for giving me part of your Sunday.
Thank you.
You're welcome to either duck out or sit, and you can watch me for 20 minutes, which I welcome you're doing, so hang out if you like. So, okay, my dear listeners, now that we broaden the focus to anything related to work, if you or someone you love cares about work, has got a problem at work and would like me to try to help you get unstuck, I do what are called workovers. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 4-WORKOVER, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to start by talking about, while we're waiting for the calls to come in, there is this, it's all easy. It's easy to be rational about what one should do in looking for a job. But there are so many people who are filled with fear, and so they don't do anything at all. They sit on the sidelines. So I thought I would take a little time to talk about some of the most common fears that people have in looking for a job. A lot of people don't look for a job because they're afraid if they do that and they don't have success, it'll confirm their greatest fear that they're unhirable. So it's better to probably think of it this way. Of course, it's possible that you may find that nobody wants to hire you. But it's much better to know that you've set, for example, a too lofty career goal sooner than later. Yeah, your self-esteem is going to take a hit, but then you're going to be able to redirect your job search to positions you're more likely to land a job in and succeed at. This is going to seem like a weird thing, but I was at Popeye's, the chicken place, yesterday. It's where my dear friend and former doctoral advisor, Michael Scriven, and I, we get together once a month for what we call a pop chat. And they make the best fried chicken and best biscuits. And every time we're there, the servers they're making, I'm sure, $10 an hour. They look like they're having a good time. They're always very nice to every customer. They're nice to each other. It's relaxed. So you may, if you're afraid of looking for a job, maybe you're looking for some middle management job in company or nonprofit or government or whatever, and let's say you didn't get it. And worst case, there's always a job at the fast food joint. There are worse things. What's the most depressing I find for most of my clients is sitting around doing nothing. Forget about the $10 an hour you're going to make, but that's something. But sitting at home thinking what a loser you are, that's devastating. So if you're afraid of confirming that you're not hireable, realize that there's going to be some job that you are hireable for, and better to find, and maybe you're not unhireable. Let's say, in fact, that you do, if you do crystallize what you really bring to the table, that you are this good analyst at quantitative data looking at big financial data sets, or that you are, you have the magical ability to convince fat cats to open their pockets to you, or that you just are, you have the ability of organizing all the details and being the world's ultimate personal, you know, office organizer. If some dentist's office is a chaotic mess, you'd be good at that. Make a list of all the things that you have done in the past that might be marketable, and you probably won't end up at Popeyes. But certainly sitting on the side and being afraid guarantees that you'll be depressed and unemployed. Unless you've got a sugar daddy or a sugar mommy, I guess, if that exists, taking care of you. Another fear. I'll give my phone number again. If you you have a work problem or somebody you love has a work problem and you'd like me to try to help you try to get unstuck, the phone number for a work over here at Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, the price is certainly right, 0 Zippo Nada, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. There's this other fear that many job seekers have. They're afraid of letting people know you're looking for work. Of course, especially if your peers are well-employed, it can feel embarrassing to let them know you're looking for a job. You may wonder if they think, geez, boy, the unemployment rate is so low. If she's needing a job, she must be some loser. So you kind of want to avoid the uncomfortability and you don't ask your friends or colleagues. But the reality is, as you know, friends and colleagues are the best source of job leads. So you don't ask them, you're dramatically reducing your chances. So here's how you might rethink it so you're not so afraid to tell your friends. There's no need to tell them you're a basket case. You don't have to say, I can't find a job, I'm desperate. You can, for example, say, well, I was laid off and I'm treating this as an opportunity to find better work. So I'm looking for a job in probably in human resources where maybe I could use my ability to understand what works in an organization and I like diversity issues. You know anybody I should talk with? So you're not sounding like a loser. You're trying to capitalize on your strengths and moving forward. Or you may even go the other way around. You say, you know, I've just passed 40. I'm sick and tired of just doing what I was supposed to do. I've quit my job, and I really think that my best strengths are in digital marketing for nonprofit causes, and I would love to be able to help some good nonprofit do that. You might, you know somebody. That's not sounding like a loser. That's somebody, someone who's got the guts to quit their crapola job and do something. I just spoke, you know, I guess I can say this on the, can I say this about your former job?
Sure.
He was a lawyer. He was an unhappy lawyer, and he quit finally in midlife or whatever. He said, damn it, that, you know, I've had enough of this.
I wasn't yet in midlife when I quit.
Okay, but you quit after being a lawyer. You went to law school and all. You had done it for 10 years, I thought.
Yeah, I was a civil litigator for 10 years, and the path to where I am today was pretty circuitous, but I got there. So I quit being a lawyer. I'd been a freelance writer and editor. I got a job at Oracle. Then I got other startup jobs using my writing, and eventually I became somebody acquainted with small business and small business issues, and that's what helped me, kind of led me to this market research and consulting world that I'm in now.
But you had the big guts to quit.
It was very, very hard.
What actually made you do it? What made you do it, and how did you really go about getting those other jobs? It's not easy to make a career change. Walk me through what's not obvious about what you did, why you did it, what got you the guts to do it, and what you did get the job.
It took a period of years. So I knew. So my college girlfriend at the time was going to USC Film School, and I went off to law school. I went to Berkeley, and I knew instantly that I wanted to be where
where she was and not where I was. But I felt trapped, you know, by all the expectations. So it took me basically the better part of a decade to get out of there. And I did some psychotherapy. I talked to all my friends until they were bored of hearing me.
Talk about the psychotherapy. How did psychotherapy help you?
Help me address the underlying fear of making change, of leaving. Help me understand what led me into law school. You know, I met my current wife, and we were living together for 4 years before we got married, and that was instrumental in feeling like the bottom wasn't going to fall out, I wasn't going to be unattractive, you know, out there alone, et cetera, all the fears.
A guy who wasn't bringing in money.
Well, right, that was a real thing. That was a very real thing for me before I met my wife.
I'm listening to 18th century, believe it or not, French and Russian short stories. And back then, they were always talking about the fact that if a guy isn't bringing in money, he can't get a woman.
Right.
But here we are in this post-feminist era, and it's still true. It's bizarre.
That's how I felt. And so being with my wife and she had a stable job, that was instrumental. Finally, you know, the economy was pretty good in the late 90s when I quit. And, you know, I had a friend who challenged me. You've been talking about this for years. Why don't you do something about it? By that point, I had weaned myself out of the big firm environment, and I was working on my own. Wasn't that hard to sort of give up what was a smaller income. I'd been a freelance writer off and on for years, and I had to make some baby steps in the beginning, but it led me to, it led me to other stuff.
How'd you convince Oracle to hire you, given your...
Well, that's a crazy story. So I took a copy editing class in San Francisco, and I forget the organization. It was a nonprofit that was teaching editing and writing skills. So I took a copy editing class. We went around the room. I said what I was doing. I'm a lawyer, but I don't like it, blah, blah, blah. Somebody in the class called me up and said, hey, we have a need for somebody with your skills. My boss likes people like you. So I went in for an interview. I had stayed up all night to finish a legal brief I was doing, sort of the last legal piece of work that I was doing for somebody else. I went in. We had a great interview, the boss and I. And he offered me a job on the spot. I was ecstatic because it was a non-law job. He turned out to be the worst boss ever. I spent 6 months there. It was hellish. But then that gave me a platform to pursue other stuff. And so then I applied for other things. And luckily, the internet was happening and there, you know, people were needed. And I got a couple of opportunities through that.
Again, a good practical takeaway is reality is that you can kill two birds with one stone with training. You get training in something, and then you've got people, whether it be the instructor or the fellow students, they get to see the human being there. You're not just some bits and bytes which can be BS'd so well on LinkedIn, for example.
I know you're going to go to the phone, but one thing that I would say is that I put myself in situations where I was interested. Education was something interesting to me, and being, you know, improving my skills as a writer and editor was interesting to me, and putting myself in that situation led to something positive.
So before I go to the phones, you sound like you've been doing this digital marketing for a while. Is it still the thing you're mainly interested in, or what do you give a crap about now, really?
Some of this stuff is boring to me, and some of it is really interesting. And without going into an elaborate discussion of that, I struggle with it a little bit because I've been doing it for 15 years, a version of what I'm doing today. I'm really interested in a lot of the sort of larger problems in the world. You know, I feel like who's going to win, Google or Facebook, is not that meaningful in the scheme of things. So, I mean, those are things that I'm thinking about. It's like, how can I use my skills in a way that's going to be socially beneficial?
What's one, if I put a gun to your head and I said there was one big issue that either you feel more, you care about more, or maybe something in your background or expertise makes you more qualified to make a bigger difference. Can you think of what one thing would be?
It's a hard question to answer. I can think of how I might apply my skills, but I think education is important.
Okay. And we're going to play a game. I want to try to be helpful. See if I can. Say you wear glasses, so I'm sure you've been to the eye doctor, and the eye doctor asks you, is it better with lens one or lens two, as a way of kind of playing hot and cold to get you to the right lens. So I'm going to do that with this. So education, would you rather focus on creating the better online training or better online elementary school education?
Neither. I mean, I think conventional schools, public education needs to be.
Conventional schools.
Yeah.
And would it be...
online education is great.
Okay. Would it be the lowest achieving kids, or would it be gifted kids whose needs are unmet, like in blue-collar schools?
It's both. I've seen both sides. It's really hard because...
Okay, about both. Okay. Would it be local, or would it be national?
Local.
So local, would it be... would you be actually working in the school yourself, or would you be consulting with them?
I don't have an education background, so I would probably be consulting in some capacity.
So let's say I'm the principal of the. You live what city do you live in?
I live in Oakland.
You live in Oakland. Okay. Pick a school that you could see you would like to serve. Pick one just for the hell of it.
Montera Middle School, daughter went.
Right. Okay, great. So I'm the principal of Montera Middle School, and I say to you, Greg, I'll give you any work you want here as long as it's going to make the biggest difference for humankind.
I haven't thought all this through. You're putting me on the spot with all these questions.
That's what we do. You're not committing to
anything. I think you have some callers that want to talk to you.
You don't want to?
No, I'll go ahead. I'll answer
the
question.
What do you want to do?
Well, I mean, an obvious thing for me to do is to take my digital knowledge and use that in some capacity for some larger good. But in a school situation, I would probably try and do something with kids who were disadvantaged around, connecting them up with some of these companies and giving them exposure maybe to some of these opportunities.
So would you run a little program that would bring those people from Facebook, LinkedIn, Google, Twitter,
yes.
Snapchat, and
yes.
bring them in to do little interactive things, and you'd bring the kids to the workplace?
Both ways, yeah.
So if I said, I'm not saying it's going to commit to anything, but if I said the little takeaway from our few-minute conversation is you should meditate upon whether you should write a one-pager little plan and send it to the – or show up at the principal's office and make an appointment to see the principal at Montera. Does that feel off-base or on-base?
It's somewhere in between. I mean, I think that it's not a bad idea, actually. But it's not something I've thought about clearly. But it's not a bad idea.
How could you tweak the idea to make it something that's better that you're more likely to act on?
I'm quite busy right now. That's why I'm not likely to act on it. I've got a lot of obligations at work.
Right. So if a year from now or after, when the smoke clears,
yeah.
would that be something you would do, or is it still something that feels
wrong
about
it? Here's something sort of off-base but related, which I think is interesting. So there are all these people out there who are basically being discarded by society, people whose skills are not valued or people who are in disadvantaged, lower-income situations. Ex-cons, right? There's an enormous need for people with technical skills. And so you could train a lot of these people to do technical jobs. You're bored by that, no?
No. I'm just
the job training around some of these new technologies, what's going to happen is there's 6% of the American workforce are cashiers, right? Waitresses and waiters are cashiers. A lot of those people are going to be replaced by technology.
Absolutely.
So you go to McDonald's now, you see 10 people in Times Square, New York. You got 10 people there at the register. In 5 years, there'll be 3 people there or 2 people there, and people will be using touch screens.
They do that at Applebee's now and Chili's.
Right.
They're going to be replacing waiters with
Precisely.
Touch screens. Yeah.
Precisely. So those people are being discarded, right? So you said work at Popeyes. Now that may be a great environment, but there's ways to bridge the gap between the needs of these new next generation companies and a lot of the people who are underemployed or who wouldn't normally think of themselves as candidates for these roles. And you can do that with skills training, technical training. You don't need a 4-year college degree.
Now let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hi, it's you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I had two things. I wanted to say something about the fear situation.
Good.
And because I think fear, I had reasonably good jobs, but I think fear did at certain points in my life get in my way of getting better jobs. And then I retired for a year, and then I was looking for a part-time job, and I couldn't find a great part-time job, and I saw a full-time job at a Lawrence Berkeley lab, and I said, well, sounds a lot what I've done. I'm going to apply, what the hell, And I got the interview, and they called me back, and everybody loved me on the panel interview, and then I interviewed with the guy I'd be working for directly, and I guess he had some doubts. So I went off to Hawaii with a girlfriend for a vacation, and we're on the beach, and I get an email, well, we think we're not going to, we're going to hold off, we're going to talk to more people, and maybe repost the job. But meanwhile, I know the person who's leaving the job is leaving in a week. And I just thought, well, they're stuck. They're stuck. So I call them up and I say, maybe you want someone, I don't know, I email them. Maybe you want someone to fill in for a week or two till you find someone to fill the job. And like within an hour, I get an email back. Please call us. Yes, And worked there for 2 weeks, and they were begging me to take the job.
Really? Great.
But the only reason I could do that was because I was retired. I was on vacation. I didn't really care. I didn't have a big emotional investment in it.
Well, two things. Certainly, some of it is that. Certainly, unfortunately, people react poorly to desperation. You would think that kind people would react well to desperation. But in reality, you're not caring much was very smart. The other thing is you're making them kind of an offer they can't refuse, saying, hey, I can fill in for you put yourself in their shoes. You realize they needed somebody temporarily until they found somebody better. And so you really put yourself in that employer's shoes, which is very, very important. Are you working there?
I worked there and it turned out the guy I was interviewing for, I didn't know this at the interview, he was the assistant director. The next week, he got appointed director of Lawrence Berkeley Lab.
Wow.
So it was like a great job, not just an okay job. It was a great job.
And did you leave or stay?
I worked a little over 4 years, and then I retired again.
Okay. What are you doing? Anything interesting you're doing with your time that you want to share with us, or should I let you go?
You know, I've just been kind of enjoying myself. I have grandchildren, small grandchildren, and I wanted to spend time with them, and I've been exercising more. I've been really getting anything serious yet.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. Good tips. Thank you very much. We've still got a couple minutes left, so I'm going to share a couple more of these fears of... if you want to call, you can. Maybe we can sneak in a call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, if you want to work over, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Another fear that people have about looking for a job is they're afraid of getting another job at which they're unhappy or unsuccessful. Let's say, you know, especially if you've not been happy or successful in your previous jobs, and you're afraid if you land a job, you're simply going to be back again in that unpleasant situation. Well, here's a way you might want to reframe it. You can reduce that risk of being unhappy by remembering that in the job interviews, you can vet the employer just like they're vetting you. The metaphor is a first date. It's not like you're a supplicant begging the prelate for absolution. You can ask questions during, not just at the end, you know, do you have any questions, but throughout you could pepper the interview with, you know, well, tell me a little bit about what it's like to work for you, or what would you hope I'd accomplish in the 30 days, or why is the position open? Did somebody leave the job? You know, so vetting them, or another question I love is, you know, every workplace culture is a little different. What's the workplace culture like here? That way you don't come off as desperate. You're checking them out like they're checking you out. And you know, as just like the previous caller, employers like somebody who's not desperate, who says, you know, I'm open to working for you. I might be a good fit, but let's see if it's a good fit. It's like a first date. It's like if you were on a first date and the first person said right away, in 10 minutes, I love you, or at least I want to go to bed with you, or whatever, it's too much, too fast. You know, you've got to take some time. And so that's my thought about that. And by the way, also, after you've been offered the job, you again can avoid the possibility of being unhappy if you ask to come to the workplace to negotiate terms. That's going to give you the opportunity to chat with employees in the break room and observe the vibe. I mean, do the people seem engaged but content, or are they unhappy? So let's see, another fear. I got to give you another one before I end the show here. Sometimes people are afraid of working because they're afraid of making somebody else sad. Maybe if you land a job, especially if it's a good job, maybe your romantic partner who's got a less good job is going to feel inferior in comparison. You don't want to make that person feel bad. In my honest reaction, that's crazy. Isn't denying yourself good work too high a price? Wouldn't it be wiser to search for a good job and encourage that loved one also to find a good job? Or maybe help that person understand that a good job isn't the only indicator of a person's worth. You may point out, for example, that he or she does great volunteer work or is an exemplary romantic partner. One more. I got to do one more, a quick one. Fear of selling yourself. You somehow believe that self-promotion is unseemly, it's pushy, so you unconsciously embrace this magical thinking that somehow you're going to get a good job without having to sell yourself. Well, that's true that sometimes jobs do drop in people's laps, but by putting all your job search eggs in that basket, it puts the odds against you. Remember that in you selling yourself, you don't have to oversell yourself. Indeed, if you give a snow job, it's often obvious. And even if you succeed in snookering a prospective employer, you're setting yourself up for failure. You know, the employer thinks you can do more than you actually can do. Better to reveal yourself, your beauty marks, and your warts without hype. And that honesty may lengthen your job search, but you're going to feel better about the way you got the job, and you're going to be more likely to land a job at which you are successful. Okay, and that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on calls, and my wife, Barbara Nemco, and I are going to debate, should a parent of a 20-something who's graduated college or dropped out but has no more than a McJob, should that parent do everything possible to help that student get started or say, I've had enough? Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For the archives of Dr. Marty Nemco's articles, information on his 7 books, including How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, go to martynemco.com. That's MartyNemko.com. And you can join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.